This is the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 21st of January, 2024. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Dale Franks. And here we are. Today's news, fairly big news for politics here in the United States. Ron DeSantis is suspending his presidential campaign. He is out. I think it's pretty much a done deal. It is a Trump-Biden fall campaign at this point. Michael, are you there? Oh, okay. Well, that was my introductory comment. It's a Trump-Biden campaign. I don't entirely know what that means or where you've gone. Vivek dropped out earlier this week and threw his support behind Trump. DeSantis now doing the same thing. It has really been a nasty primary campaign between DeSantis and Trump, and continuingly between Trump and Haley now. I don't think Haley has a hope in hell of doing anything at this point. And so I think we are now in a national election campaign. It's a foregone conclusion. And so there's been some interesting polling around this. So if we look at Real Clear Politics, who are just doing a national election, national polls don't mean much for presidential election. However, the Real Clear Politics average at this point in January, 11 months before the election, has a Real Clear Politics average of Trump ahead by 2 points. Yeah, within the margin. Also, there is so much else going on with Trump. There are the four cases that are going on against him, one of which may result in a criminal conviction. How quickly does this turn around? And this is where it gets weird, because Biden is turned into a singularly unlikable president, and people don't think he is doing the job. And indeed, if you want to look at some other pollings, we have the Harvard-Harris poll, which we are not going to go through and do a whole bunch of stuff, but voters say they have doubts about Biden's mental fitness for office, with 62% saying that they have doubts about his fitness. 64% showing that they believe Biden is too old and he's not showing that he's fit to be president. So basically, two-thirds of voters think that Biden just isn't fit as being president. Now, interestingly, of course, there is a huge split between the Dems and GOP. However, you look at independents, 63%. And by the way, something that's important to point out, nationally, voter registration, slightly more than 38% of voters are registered Democrats. Slightly more than 28% are registered Republicans. And that leaves us with this vast number in the middle, over 40% of voters who are independents. 63% think that Joe Biden is not fit for office. And if you get independents, half of independents say that Biden is getting worse as president. That's not good for Biden. However, 50% of independents say that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. And is Trump a threat to democracy or not? Well, he'll be elected, and then it'll be the last. It'll be a Hitler thing. It'll be the last election. He'll dissolve the Reichstag, and the only political party will be the Nazi party, and then there we'll go. Now we're living in Nazi Germany. Yeah, exactly what threat is. Well, we talked about this last week. It's a silly argument. He's a threat to democracy. Every other institution would have to fail and would have to roll over like a weasel and expose its softest parts to just let Donald Trump, I guess, declare himself president for life, right? I suppose, but now you've got 59% of independents who say that he has committed crimes. So 59% say that Trump is a crook. These are independents now. 59% say Trump is a crook, and two-thirds, 64%, say that Biden is too old. So one is too old, one is a crook. So I guess the question is, between too old and crook, who wins? Yeah, I just don't.
It might not be the same independents coming out each time, and how invested are they in it? If they don't like anybody, will they show up to vote at all?
Yeah,
or vote third party.
By the way, I hate to interrupt to chat. Thanks for telling me that Michael is very quiet. He should no longer be very quiet. I thought the USB through button was pressed. It was not, but you should all be hearing Michael as well. Also, I am told that your hair, Michael, looks very good today.
Oh, well, thank you.
So you are clearly today's fashion plate. My hair always looks the same.
I think it looks great.
So, yeah, I don't know. You know, Trump won last time primarily because he was running against Hillary Clinton, who is one of the most unpopular.
Yeah.
I mean, she is a historically unpopular political figure.
Yeah. And she took a good 20-some years to get to that point.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, it wasn't like it was undeserved. I mean, God knows, right. She worked for that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, she got it, and he won. It was a very narrow margin of victory, but he won. And, indeed, he didn't win the popular vote.
Popular vote, right.
Nobody other than Obama has won the popular vote in the 21st century, so why are we surprised? But it now puts us in a position that we've never been in, really, I don't think, in our lifetime, where it is January, the New Hampshire primary hasn't even occurred, and we're already in a two-person race. That hasn't happened in my lifetime.
Yes, like never. I mean, that's just, it's never happened before. Where you had, of course, the first time that everybody's experiencing where you have a former president running against a former president. We've never had that before. I mean, we haven't. It's happened one other time.
It has happened. Grover Cleveland, but now we're going all the way back to the 1800s to find that. So I don't know what the rest of the primary race looks like. As far as I can tell, Nikki Haley, who has no path to victory. It's clear that for whatever reason, Republican voters are sold on Trump. And nobody's going to beat him. And we were looking for Iowa to see what the indicators might be about, because last podcast was the day before Iowa. So, you know, as we were talking about there, we'll know after Iowa how strong Trump support is. Well, it's over 50%. So he is the nominee. And
And he
with
won Iowa by the largest majority of any GOP candidate ever.
Yeah, at the same time, it was one of the worst turnouts for an Iowa caucus ever. Something like 15% of the electorate showed up.
Although it's typically not super high. It wasn't that high when Biden got nominated either. Although I think there's runs, the Democratic caucus runs slightly differently because of the way they pick the delegates or something, but.
Yeah, so I don't know what the rest of this is going to be an unprecedented presidential campaign. Now, what Grover Cleveland had working for him when he returned for his second term in office, because let's not forget, Grover Cleveland did win his second term after being tossed out for 4 years. But when he was running for his second term, he wasn't facing four indictments in state and federal court.
In fact, no presidential candidate ever has.
No, so
Well, maybe I think there was no in the teens under the Alien and Sedition Act. I mean, the Sedition Act. The socialist candidate. What was his name? Al something.
no, I think that would be Gene Debs.
Eugene Debs. Yep. He was under indictment from the Wilson administration for violating the Sedition Act. So that's the closest we've come.
Yeah, and nobody expected Eugene V. Debs to win that presidential election.
No.
What we have is a major party candidate who is under indictment, and if he gets convicted, see, and this is the thing, all of these polls that we have seen up to now don't tell us anything, and I don't think we'll learn anything about, especially how independents are going to break, and. Unless Trump gets convicted on in one of these trials. And if he does, okay, New York is not a criminal trial, so who cares? The worst that can happen is they'll take away his business license in New York. Okay, big deal. He'll go to Delaware.
Billion
Ta-da.
dollars. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. But, Atlanta, we're talking about possible prison time.
Yes.
Because that.
And I thought there was one in New York that was also criminal.
Well, here's the problem. I am not well versed in all of the jurisdictions in which Donald Trump is now on trial.
I can't keep them all straight. The Fannie Willis one is, and
E. Jean Carroll one.
oh yeah, I forgot about that one. That one's so stupid. The what's her name in New York City? Letitia
Letitia James.
James. Yeah. She's the AG for New York City, right?
Right.
But there's the state AG case against him too, I think. And I can't remember for what.
Yeah, well, there's the Jack Smith
Well, there's the Jack Smith,
case.
that's in DC.
So let's just say that Donald Trump has a lot of irons in the legal fire at the moment. And Atlanta, the federal case, I mean, we are talking about the possibility of jail time. So does how does that what is that what do independent voters do? Because independent voters have said if he gets convicted of a crime, they're not supporting him. If you can't win at least, and by the way, it's not even half of independents, considering that there is a 10-point spread between Democratic and Republican registration nationwide. You've got to win 60% of independents.
Yeah.
That's a
Except
big ask.
I would imagine that his base is that Trump's base is largely independents who may vote Republican. But remember how many people he drew in from the sidelines and really didn't vote at all. They'll vote for him, but they won't vote for just anybody. So I'm wondering if how much of that independent vote are hardcore Trump voters, no matter what.
Well, the other imponderable is that you have, as we've talked about for several months now, two-thirds of the electorate don't want either Trump or Biden running.
That's the most worrisome thing.
So who shows up in November?
Yeah.
Because I have a suspicion that a redo of 2020 is not going to result in either candidate receiving 81 million votes. I mean,
that was a popular vote win.
Yeah. I mean, unless something happens to fundamentally change this, I don't know that turnout is even going to be all that great. Now, does that help?
That's Donald, what I'm wondering.
Does that help Donald Trump? I mean, if Donald Trump has the more convinced and active and convicted voter base, does low turnout help him? Because they're going to show up and vote for him no matter what?
No, I think he's got the Hillary Clinton problem in that he's just, you know, indelibly unlikable to so many people. And although some of those people would still vote for him, a bunch of those people who would normally just vote Democrat may be upset with the choice they have, but they're scared. They're literally scared of what happens if Trump becomes president again, because, you know, they're told that they're going to re-education camps and they're going to be disappeared and all this other nonsense.
Yeah, and who's so he
they'll
come?
I mean, they may say that they don't like him now, they don't like Biden now, but they always tend to come home to roost in November.
Yeah, Democrats always return to the Democratic Party, and Republicans are the ones that tend to just not show up.
I think that's probably right.
But I think this is so unique. For each candidate, basically two-thirds of the electorate don't like them. One because they think he's a crook, yeah. One because they think he's a nut. So, well, not a nut. Let's just say senile.
And I
don't know. I don't know what the draw is to, do I vote for, if you're an independent voter, the draw is, do I vote for the crook or the nut?
Right.
Or is it, you know, I wishing emeralds on both their houses and just not showing up?
Or voting third party.
Or voting third party, you know, RFK or whoever ends up on the third party. I'm sure there'll be a libertarian, and I'm sure there'll
maybe Kanye will show back up.
A green, but yeah, there we go. Kanye. Oh my.
With his solid teeth.
The nightmare scenario is that Kanye shows up and he wins Ross Perot levels of of support in the national election. I don't know how to even begin predicting what might happen now. I think the only way that we're not going to know anything really until the last couple of weeks before the election, and start looking and seeing if Donald Trump gets convicted of something and then he starts showing up consistently 20 points behind, I think it's over.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Because no matter how bad the polling is, 20 points is even with iffy polls, is a really big spread. I mean,
and yeah, that's a sizable representative sample.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you'd have to be looking at a 10-point plus margin of error.
Right.
Which, you know, polls have been kind of iffy, but I don't think anybody's ever been outside of 5%. Even the bad.
I know one thing we can predict is how this is going to play out in the media. Now that we're down to a 2-person race, this is going to play out in the media.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be Trump attacks. Constantly.
And there's going to be new scandals they're going to try to dig up. They're also going to go after anybody within Trump's sphere. Every one of them is going to be a secret Nazi or a child rapist or...
Oh, yeah. It's going to go nonstop.
Animal hater. It's going to be something.
And I've seen a lot of people on Twitter saying this is exactly what the Democrats wanted. They figured if they indicted Donald Trump, it would boost his support. And they did it. It boosted his support. He's the one they want to run against because they think they can beat him easily.
They've got some good reason to think that. Especially if they can keep some of those rules in place that they did for 2020.
Except 2/3 of the electorate think Joe Biden's a nut. That is the handicap they have to
Except, well,
cross.
how many of them think that he's actually running anything?
Yeah, well, that's the
See,
other
the real
thing.
question should be, it's not that whether or not Biden's inept, is it his administration inept? I mean, I know how I'd vote that way, but not everybody sees the same things I do or thinks the same things about him.
Yes, I mean,
So,
when you look at Biden, his central policy seems to be vacationing at Delaware.
right. And saying stupid stuff whenever he gets off the leash. But for the most part, he just does. I mean, he is a third term of Obama. America bad, rest of the world, especially if they're a communist or socialist nation, are great. We should be more accommodating to them. We should give up all our stuff so that they can live better. Amen. We can do it. Si se puede.
Yeah, so I have no predictions. I have no way of knowing what is going to happen, other than I think it's really easy to predict that the mainstream media is going to go on a full court anti-MAGA press.
Now, that may have repercussions of its own. I mean, with Twitter being freed up to put the kibosh on some of these scandals and stories and whatever else, that helps. I mean, it almost like how the blogosphere helped back in 2004, 2005, quickly crowdsourcing all these stupid claims about how Bush, like, flooded New Orleans on purpose and wouldn't let anybody out. Just all the crazy ass shit.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think Twitter matters. I don't think there are enough people who are on Twitter who are plugged in enough to see that for it to make any difference at all. I mean,
The only difference
there are a lot of boomers on Facebook, but Twitter really is the province of the terminally politically junkified portion of the population. And that's a pretty
True.
small percentage overall.
But I meant more in the in terms of getting rebuttals out there quickly, getting fisking out there quickly.
Yeah, but who's going to see it?
Well, those things then get picked up by right media. Then eventually they get forced into the mainstream media. It's a slow process and it's not as good as it could be, but it is a process. And you have to, especially as the feds and the media have just been going so far over the top for the past 3 years. It's really clicking to some people. I guess the current lingo is a lot of people getting red pilled, right?
Yeah. Well, this past week, Jim Jordan, looking into the January 6th investigation, it appears that the FBI was looking for, anyone who, prior to January 6th, they were, shopping at, Cabela's or buying Bibles. I mean, they were just looking for, and they're looking for signs that you might be an insurrectionist, and it's even gotten down to, well, did you buy a Bible? Because that might mean that you're an insurrectionist.
And then did you go to Cabela's?
Yeah, or Bass Pro Shops.
Right. Which
That
the
is
link
just,
there obviously is that they tend to sell guns, not everywhere, but
yeah.
in most places.
So that level of surveillance and overreach. Especially whenever, as did you buy a religious text like a Bible? We're getting into some awfully murky territory now.
Oh, you remember the civil liberties rightly calling out the Patriot Act back in the early 2000s about why do you need to know what library books I check out? Wait, how is that not a violation of my rights? I mean, they went ape shit over that stuff.
Yeah, and as it turns out, rightly so.
Yeah.
There was,
And where are they now?
yeah, so maybe some of this overreach is going to, red pill some voters. I just don't know. As far as
We also aren't, I
go
was going to
ahead.
say, we also don't know what other mishaps, wars might break out. There may be many different things that could happen in the next several months before we get to the election. and that could change some minds.
Yeah, well, there are weird things happening. For example, in Fulton County, Georgia, Fannie Willis, apparently the guy that she hired to help out with the Donald Trump prosecution is somebody with whom she was having an affair. He was married at the time. His name is Nathan Wade. Having an affair with him, and
No relation.
yeah, no relation, and sending DA business to him, including the Trump prosecution. One of the people who are charged in Willis's indictment is Michael Roman, who used to be a White House aide, and he ran Trump's Election Day operations. He basically filed in federal court saying a couple of things. First of all, Wade or Willis never had the legal authority to appoint Wade as a special prosecutor. Second, that they have been engaged in an improper, clandestine personal relationship during the case, which resulted in them profiting significantly from the prosecution at the expense of taxpayers, and claiming that Willis and Wade took lavish vacations together. Now, that original filing from Michael Roman had no proof. Where the proof existed was in the divorce case between Nathan Wade and his now ex-wife. And so Fannie Willis made a move to have that divorce record sealed, which is unusual in many states and certainly unusual in Georgia. And before that motion could go through, Nathan Wade's ex-wife decided to release a couple of the receipts from this whole thing. So we can see credit card receipts for spending that was made for Willis and Wade to take a couple of trips. And we're going to scroll down and we'll just see what kind of trips are we talking about. Well, here we go. Here is a Delta flight to California where they went to Napa Valley. That sounds nice. $12,045.09. California, an expensive place to vacation, in case you hadn't wondered. There are more economical places you can go. For example, you can go to the Bahamas for $2,151, which seems a lot more reasonable. Somewhat less reasonable would be Aruba for $5,730.91. Or you could take a nice cruise. Everybody wants to take a cruise. Royal Caribbean, fantastic cruise line. And really, somewhat less than $3,000 on a Royal Caribbean cruise. $1,387 for
That's
one
pretty
ticket.
good. I've got to give them credit for their thriftiness. That's
Yeah,
pretty good.
$1,387 for one ticket, $1,284.85 for another ticket. And look, really, whenever you put it like that, including, all that you can eat, unlimited food, full
Yeah.
service on a cruise, for a week, that $1,300 seems pretty reasonable to me.
Yeah.
So sure, they spent a lot of money on the
Way to save the
California trip,
taxpayers' money.
but we're certainly saving the taxpayers' money on our cruises
It
to,
could have cost you $5,000 a person, all right?
Aruba, the Bahamas, a Royal Caribbean cruise. Really,
Jamaica,
I think what this
Aruba.
shows us is that the Caribbean is a very affordable destination.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Somewhat less affordable, Audi Atlanta, $6,014.65. Now, look, obviously you're going to need to have a set of wheels. But I mean, really, when you look at just the vacation, two tickets for a week in the Royal Caribbean costs half as much as the down payment for your Audi. Look, it's just a good vacation choice. So there is a hearing on the 15th for Fannie Willis to talk to a judge to explain exactly what the hell is happening here.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that the demand to seal the divorce records is probably moot at this point. So
Yeah. Although there is one good argument that Fannie Willis made with respect to the divorce proceedings and the subpoena that she's under, that her participation with Wade or not is irrelevant to their divorce proceedings, because they both say that the divorce is due to irreconcilable differences on both sides, and that was long before she even met Wade. It's a good point, and it's a fair point to make. The counter to that, though, is the spending, and that's what she's introduced. She's not looking for, it's a no-fault divorce. So she's not looking for fault. What the wife is looking for is to establish the actual finances, to know how to divvy everything up. And with him spending all this lavish money that he was claiming were business expenses, which half of it was hers as his wife, well, there's an accounting to be had here. So I don't think that motion to quash is going to succeed. And I do believe these court records are going to come in. You can have what's called judicial notice, that the judge is empowered to take notice of legal court filings or other legal happenings as evidence, even though they're not introduced by a specific witness.
Right, but the ruling is this exists, so I'm sorry, I got a little confused at what I was looking at here. So I think one of the interesting things about this is, what does it do to the prosecution? I'm very interested in Michael Roman's plea, because does this mean that the whole prosecution is illegitimate? And if so, does that mean we got to start it all over again? Does it mean that Willis and Wade have to recuse themselves?
I'm not real clear on, yes, it's ethically suspect, but is that harmful to Roman? Yes, it's ethically suspect, but does that mean that everything that went into the prosecution, the building of the case, that's all suspect? I'm not seeing the connection necessarily.
Well, I mean,
I'm not sure
obvious.
that the action goes away, but I think you could remove those two lawyers.
Yeah, and then it all has to start over.
I
I
mean, it
mean,
doesn't even start over. It's the DA's office. They got lots of other lawyers on the case. Some even actually have experience with this type of case,
yeah, well,
unlike
that sure wouldn't have to start from
one of the
scratch.
other people involved.
There'd probably have to be some sort of continuance while somebody else brought themselves up to speed on it, though, one would assume.
On the facts and stuff, sure, but that's what the main like deputy prosecutor or whatever, the one who's actually doing most of the work, Wade really isn't doing all that much. How many times have I heard that? And I mean and I mean he's getting paid the most. He has no expertise in this area whatsoever. I don't even know if he does criminal law, quite honest, but it's just the remedy sought by Roman, I think, may be a stretch too far. I think people are getting out ahead of themselves if they think this case is going to go away. Now, will it be delayed beyond the election? Yeah, I kind of think that is going to happen.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. If we can delay, and look, it looks like the other case that's really dangerous to Donald Trump is the federal case that Jack Smith is working on.
Jack Smith, yeah.
And that's not going to be wrapped up prior to the election. As much as Jack Smith has been trying to get that to happen, it's just not. So.
No, yeah, he stepped on too many landmines. There's too many things that are going to get appealed. There's too many, motions to be made. It's a very, very complicated case.
And so far, he's batting 1,000 in appellate court, Jack Smith. And by 1,000, I mean he's losing every single one of these appealed requests. So I think this drags out prior to the election. So if that is so, let us say that Donald Trump does win election. What happens to the trials? Do they continue? Again, talking about being in uncharted territory, there is nothing that's going on in American politics that we have an answer for, that it's never happened before.
It's a confluence of all these unexpected, rather bizarre events at once, which to some people might be a coincidence, but.
Yes, because in 1787, the delegates in Philadelphia said, shit is never going to happen. And so, therefore, it's...
Sit down, Hancock. That's never going to happen. We don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it gets us into Trump's immunity from prosecution. How much does he have?
What is that based on? I know there's the DOJ opinion about not prosecuting a sitting president under federal law.
Right. And but that's
why can't he be prosecuted under state? I guess did we go through that with Clinton?
Well, the trouble with Clinton was that was a civil trial.
Bill Clinton. But it was something maybe with his bar license or something. I can't remember, but there were some federal issues about suing him, not federal, no, state issues about suing him. It's been a long time.
Here's the problem. The Constitution says nothing about presidential immunity.
That's right.
Not a word. Now, it does say that members of Congress, so senators and members of the House, are immune.
The speech and debate clause.
Yeah, are immune from arrest when on their way to or from a session of Congress.
Right.
So there is that. So there is some level of immunity granted in the Constitution to members of Congress. But the president isn't mentioned. So now we're back into penumbras and emanations of immunity for the president. Donald Trump's argument, as god-awfully as he frames it, is that president is generally immune from prosecution for his official acts while he's in office.
That may be true. I don't know what the precedent says. I don't know how they cobbled that together. As a policy, maybe that's a good idea. Again, agnostic. But
nothing covers it. Have reiterated
several times. It's unprecedented. We don't really have a direct answer.
Yeah, there's no case law. There's nothing in the Constitution. And, you know, what you said about the DOJ and their policy not to prosecute a sitting president, that's just DOJ policy.
That's just policy. That's right.
That's a policy statement that says this would be real tricky. Maybe it'd be best to wait. And so... Well,
and that's who it came up under, too.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know what that means. And if he gets convicted after he's does he get convicted after he's elected? Does Jack Smith's case now go into abeyance? We have two ways to get rid of a president formally, either impeachment or the 25th Amendment. And I suppose you could make the argument that he can be prosecuted after he's removed from office. But if you get into, but Trump is right that if you say I can accuse a president of a crime for his official acts as president, what we're going to end up with is the Roman Republic, where the day your consulship expires,
right,
you end up getting sued for your life for treason or malfeasance in office. One of the things that brought down the Roman Republic was the fact that everything was so politicized that after you served your 1 year as one of the two consuls of Rome, you found yourself right in a Roman court having to defend yourself from permanent exile from Rome because we'd politicized everything. That's certainly a situation that we don't want.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and there used to be a thing, it's called champerty, where, and this was in England, where opponents of the current king or baron or whatever could buy up claims that people had or potentially had against the crown or, you know, whoever the sitting authority was, and then pursue those in pursuit really of political victory. They didn't really care about the money. They were just using it as a lever to get him out so that they could then put who they preferred in. And it's called champerty, and it was outlawed under English common law, I mean, a good 600 years ago. So that exists in American law, and it's generally where some of the background comes for these bubbling thoughts up through the legal process. What Trump is predicting is not only historical, but it's happened several times. So there is some meat on that bone. However, is it prohibitive? Is it mandatory? Is it something that can be, should be honored, or is it something that you're just not legally allowed to do?
Yeah, who knows? That's the problem.
Right.
Who knows? We don't have a legal remedy for this. I mean, look, federal law prohibits a president, thank you, John Kennedy and Dick Nixon, from assassinating having a foreign head of state assassinated. Right? Mm-hmm. So like Jack Kennedy tried to have Fidel Castro killed like five different times. Explosives, there was the poison cigar caper, there was all of this stuff.
You joker.
There's all of this stuff that he tried to do. Congress then said, okay, presidents can't kill foreign heads of states. That's illegal. Okay, so what happens if Trump bumps off and let's de-Trumpify this. So what happens if the president orders a foreign head of state killed and the CIA does it? Can we then criminally prosecute the president? Because now we're talking about an official act. So can we then criminally prosecute the president while he is in office? Does he remain president? Or do we have to impeach him first for bumping off a foreign head of state? And only after he's impeached can he be criminally tried. Trump's argument is, nope, you got to impeach me first. And if you can't impeach me.
That was laid out actually quite well in that. I can't remember which case that is. I think that's the Jack Smith case.
Yeah. And look, whether you like Trump or not, and I've seen a lot of people, you know, Twitter, of course, everybody is so sure of what the actual truth is on Twitter. And I've seen so many people on Twitter saying, well, this is just
Twitter law school is pretty amazing.
Yeah, Twitter law school is great. And all these people come in, well, this is just a completely illegitimate argument. It would make the president a king who could do anything he wants. Well, I don't think so. I think the danger of just being able to politically prosecute a president for acts that he did, his official acts, while he is the sitting president, is not a direction we want to go. I mean, just for prudential reasons, you don't want to go that way. I think we have to go through all of the extra hoops of the Constitution of tossing him out of office before we can prosecute him for his official acts. Now, if the president, you know, poisons his wife in the White House, okay, now I think probably, but again, then that would be a local D.C. Well, no, it happened on federal property if it was in the White House. So, okay, so do we prosecute the president for that? I think an argument would be made that, yeah, we could, but he's still president.
What's the federal crime?
Yeah, because now it's a federal crime. I mean, if he happened to do it, you know, in Anacostia, then that would be a Maryland thing, and then they would, or Virginia thing, and then they would have to prosecute him in state
court.
They'd
find a way to prosecute.
Yeah, well, I'm certain they would. So, everything that's happening is unprecedented. I find myself for the first time in my life, I'm all 60 now, of saying, I have no clue of what any of this means. That's
well,
the Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think we both know from an 80,000 foot level what it means, that as I'm sure most of our listeners, watchers, do, that it's clearly a sign of a very troubled government vis-a-vis the will of the people. There's a huge disconnect. This government is failing, and the worry is when the cascade begins, because then it goes downhill quickly. And we don't have a healthy republic. I mean, I just think it's a foregone conclusion. We do not have a healthy republic. Could we? Yes, but the very people that we need to get rid of in order to have that healthy republic are the ones that dominate all the laws, all the media, everything we see, everything we read, everything we hear. It makes it a very daunting proposition.
Well, when you talk about a cascade, I can think of very few circumstances to provoke such a cascade than having this long series of entirely unprecedented political situations arise all at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and what it does is then it forces everybody into one side or the other. Eventually it becomes just the simplest machine in the world, a wedge, and that wedge can split apart anything.
Yeah, so I just don't know where politically, I don't know where we are. So for all of our listeners, I think for the next 11 months, expect little in the way of prediction from us unless something becomes blindingly obvious. I suspect, however, that the full court press that is going to be going on in media against Donald Trump is probably going to be effective. Unless Joe Biden does something so bad and is so incompetent that Trump wins just by dint of Joe cannot be president anymore,
I just I
I think I default to Biden as winning in 2024.
I don't think Biden can win in 2024. I think the Democrats are well aware of that. I don't think you can drag down Trump enough to make Biden palatable, which is why I don't think Biden's going to be the one who's going to be listed on the ballot on November 5th. I just they're going to come up with something. It could be a Torricelli move, who knows? But they cannot get across the finish line with that idiot. They did everything within their power to drag him across the finish line in 2020.
Okay, so you're thinking that as things stand now, Trump probably wins then.
As of right this second, yes.
I'm not entirely sure where we disagree, but clearly we do somewhere.
I just think that the hate for Trump is surpassed by everyday realities of how people are having to deal. And it's just become so much more obvious to a lot more people. And that's not necessarily red pilled. That's just, hey, my grocery bill's really high. My gas bill is ridiculous. Where's all this stuff that you were supposed to do for me? I'm not feeling any of it. I didn't go to college. Why am I paying for all these student loans? And I thought I saw something or heard something at some point about how that was illegal according to the Supreme Court. So how is he able to do it? I don't know, but all I know is this isn't working. I had food on the table and some money in my pocket when Trump was in office. I think that there's plenty of that sentiment out there. And I do think it may be enough to override Biden. I think he's just so screwed up.
There is plenty of that sentiment out here. 62% of the electorate say the country is on the wrong track.
Yeah.
And in fact, the number of voters who say the country's on the right track have declined in the past month from 35 to 32%.
And when did it start the decline from wrong path to right path? Or excuse me, the opposite, right path to wrong path. Whatever that number is right there, I just can't read it. It looks like something 21.
Well, in November of 20, the wrong track dropped significantly from around, 60% down to
40%. That was right when 40%. Trump got rid of.
So, so we got rid of Trump. We're on the right track. And that lasted until June of 21, when it peaked out at around 50%. And then after June of 21, and what happened in June of 21? Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, yeah.
And then after Afghanistan, it just headed towards the basement. And it has bounced off of 30% since then. So it has held solid between right track at 30 to 40%, while wrong track has been hovering around 60%, and it's been higher. And wrong track has been hovering around 60% all the way back, since.
Yeah, so that's 60%, perigee right there. And then I guess so it's 40, a little under 40, like 30% or whatever. So there's like that one little spread there that you're just pointing to.
Yeah, and by the way, what's interesting is if you look at independents, they have been stuck at 20% to 25% right track for over a year now.
Right.
So 75% of independents say the country is on the wrong track.
Right. Well, and again, that harkens back to the $64 million question. How do you make what breaks that tie?
Yeah, and by the way, perceptions on the economy, not much different.
Almost mirror-like.
Yeah. That's 59 to 33% on the economy, vice 62 to 32%.
I mean, look at this. Can you get those both on the same page?
Sure.
Yeah, right there.
I can. Hold on.
You're doing it right there.
No, I'm.
And look I'm really how doing it. Remarkably similar those are.
Yeah, I'm not sure that people are making that fine distinction between whether the country as a whole is on the right track or just the economy is on the right track. Right. So, yeah, they are basically marching more or less in lockstep and certainly have since June of 21. So, yeah, Biden has a lot to overcome. How many of the people who dislike Trump are... Because here's the thing. Yeah, people don't like Biden. They think the country is on the wrong track, but they also thought 60% of them thought the country was on the wrong track when Donald Trump was running the show. Mm-hmm. So this, to me, seems to kind of wash out. And look, even well before the election, going back to 17, he never dropped below 50% except in March of 17. That was the only time the wrong track dropped below 50%. So...
And that was right when he fired James Comey.
No, back in 17?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was later than that. But look, he's been at above... Donald Trump was above 50% wrong track for pretty much his entire presidency. It got a little higher at the end, which, by the way, I blame on COVID and his response to COVID. And then Joe Biden got a brief... honeymoon of 4 months, well, 5 months, and then boom, right back to, well, I don't like this guy either. So we have two guys, both of whom are remarkably unpopular. This is going to come down to who decides to show up. And so from my point of view, independents, especially independent women, hate Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's true.
So are they going to be driven to polls to say, well, as bad as Joe Biden is, Donald Trump is... See, now we are having a race. This is a race for the bottom. Who do I dislike less?
Yeah.
Who is the lesser... Who is the lesser of two evils? I mean, you could make the
argument... Welcome to libertarian lands.
Yeah. Well, welcome to being a libertarian. You could make the argument that in 2020 or in 2020, for a bunch of independents, the answer was obviously... Joe Biden, who's been around for 50 years, he's a known quantity. He was the vice president. During Obama, we kind of liked Obama. It was great having the black guy as president because I voted for him because that proves I'm not racist. So he's obviously the lesser of two evils. He's an old fella, But he's the lesser of two evils from Donald Trump. So if you're an independent,
he's got a black vice president. I mean, that's got to be good, right? Oh, and she's a woman.
Yeah. So sure, he ticks all the inoffensive boxes. Now the problem is that most Americans are, unlike you and I, not political junkies, and so therefore they don't realize that Joe Biden is, and has always been, a disaster of a person. He is an awful human being, always has been.
And that's according to his colleagues.
Yeah, he's dumb as a box of rocks. There's a reason why they called him Slow Joe Biden. So I was never a big fan of Joe Biden. But now we have 4 years of him as president. And he is more unpopular than Donald Trump was. But does that mean that see, I don't know.
Yeah, what does that mean in terms of votes? It's really hard to say. I mean, we had this conversation, I remember back in 2012, when we looked at every metric that, you know, all the historic metrics. If you did not have an economy doing this, your incumbency was in danger. If you had interest rates of this and a growth rate, GDP of this, and like all this other stuff. We looked at like all these metrics and we concluded, based on historical analysis, that it just did not seem possible that Obama could win a second term. And indeed, up until October, it looked like Romney was doing pretty good. And then the whole Candy Crowley mess happened. And then all of a sudden, not only is Mitt Romney like the biggest Nazi in the world, he hates women and hates dogs and hates grandmothers. it was an absolute shellacking after that.
Yeah. The trouble with being in.
So, I mean, we can look at the polls all on. And it'll tell us where people are, but it doesn't tell us where people are on November 5th when they walk into the voting booth.
And look, I'm not entirely sure that how a person feels on November 4th, whenever voting, while close, is still merely a theoretical possibility, even though a relatively high one. When you actually walk in and you have to put a mark on that ballot or punch the chat or whatever it is that is done in your jurisdiction, pull the lever, whatever, I'm not certain that people are, in an election like this, I'm not certain that they're as firmly attached as they might otherwise be.
I think most people are, if they're attached to a policy, it's a single policy. They're a single issue voter, typically abortion. Maybe it's gay marriage or something, but if they're attached to issues, unless they're big political junkie, they aren't paying attention really. I mean, the issues aren't, I mean, we talked about this last week. It's not like the issues are batted about. It's not whether or not free markets are better than centralized economic direction. We don't have those.
Oh, yeah. We're not having that election.
No. So all we're getting to decide really is a popularity contest. I mean, it's, who's the most unlikable, and then vote for the other person. That's really all it is.
Well, if it's a popularity contest, as of December, Donald Trump wins. He has higher favorables and lower unfavorables than Joe Biden. It's close.
Right.
It's 49% net favorable for Trump and 43% net favorable for Joe Biden. So there is a 10% gap between the two of them in terms of favorability. So,
but again, let's get out of that national thinking. What is it in Georgia? What is it in North Carolina? What is it in Pennsylvania? What is it in Michigan? What is it in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and that's the problem.
That's where it's going to make a difference.
Yeah, that's the problem with national polls. National polls don't tell us much, because every national poll includes California, which contains about...
And New York.
Yeah, which contains about 20% of the electorate.
Right.
So those numbers can be skewed, but they also don't matter, because we know how California is going to vote.
Right.
Because 2/3 of registered voters in California are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less.
And then all the independents are mostly Marxists and socialists anyway.
Yeah, they're all Green Party wackos.
Right.
And look, New York is not that much different. Even though, you know,
New York City thing.
Yeah, New York
City. The rest of New York is fairly center right.
Yeah, so we're going to need to start looking at a lot of state level polls, and for whatever good they are now, you know, a year prior to the election. I don't know. Again, we're not really going to know until October, I think, how this is going to turn out. And yeah, anything could happen. I mean, look, Trump is 78. Joe Biden is 81. There's no guarantee that either of those two gentlemen are going to be alive in November.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah, but I mean, look, they're both elderly fellas. So what happens if Joe Biden or Donald Trump, one of the two, kicks the bucket? Heart attack, whatever.
Can you imagine if Trump kicks the bucket? The amount of conspiracy theory that will flood every space.
The autopsy will show he died of a heart attack.
Trump didn't kill himself.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where we're going. I mean, look, at least if Joe Biden passes away, we already know who's going to replace him. We already know how this, it's God help us, Kamala Harris. But she's the vice president. We have a mechanism for that. What happens if the Republican front runner passes away prior to the election? Now, what do? Especially if it happens during the summer when the primaries are over.
Well, the primaries in August, right? Well, I guess it's August, September, end of August.
Well, beginning the conventions are in August. Sure.
Yeah.
But
that's where they make the actual choice. And so,
but
like I said, there's always a Torricelli option where at the last minute, hey, that guy's not available. We've got a better guy right here. All packaged up, done it before. Let's go ahead and
if it goes down to the convention, which would pick the candidate at a convention for the first time almost in our entire lives, because you and I have both grown up in an era of primaries. You have to go back to the 1950s and earlier to a time when there were no primaries. There were just but it was basically just picking delegates for a convention, and you didn't pick a president until the convention.
That's literally what my alma mater, Washington and Lee, does during every presidential election. They do it the old school way, where obviously they can't have primaries, so they just do a delegate convention. And it's oddly pretty damn accurate.
Yeah, but I mean, Americans are just not used to... Americans know who the presidential candidate is going to be prior to the convention. We've all grown up in a world where we knew who the nominee was going to be because we went through all these primary elections.
And it's never turned out otherwise. There's never been a switch at the convention.
Right. And what happens if you need to pull a switch at the convention? I don't know. You talk about the cascade, and I said, when you have a whole bunch of unprecedented circumstances, that can lead to a cascade. The fact that our system at this particular point in time is so precariously balanced on these two gentlemen is a recipe for possible disaster.
Yeah. Which.
And by the way, it proves that we have a system that's not working.
Yes.
All of our institutions. It's weird. All of our institutions, governmental and otherwise, creak along and work on a day-to-day basis, which is to say people show up. They do their jobs, whatever they may be. They collect their paychecks. The institutions exist. They're working on a day-to-day
basis. They're real. They have buildings and everything.
They're real, and yet they
accomplish. Some even have SWAT teams.
And yet they accomplish nothing. All of our institutions are fundamentally broken. They exist, mm-hmm. but they just don't do what they're supposed to do. When the FBI is looking to see if you bought a Bible to determine whether or not you are a possible domestic terrorist, that's an institution that doesn't work.
It's been really interesting how the age of terrorism has really beefed up the intelligence and security state apparatus. And that's not one particular state. That's all states. Because we all share. I mean, there's famously the Five Eyes, right? All the English-speaking countries. There's lots of other little intelligence combinations and, sharing networks and whatever else. All of a sudden, this nebulous idea of, like, misinformation, disinformation, and how it's tied with national security, and then obviously terrorism. Well, man, these terms are so nebulous. We can start making all kinds of assumptions and searches. And, if we get caught, we'll just be like, oh, my bad.
All I can say is it's very, very fortunate for the national security state that 9/11 happened, because everybody was wondering what we were going to do and how things were going to work now that the Cold War was over. And ta-da, we now have an answer. Everything is about terrorism.
And then it is fought very, very similar, almost identically, in fact. I'm trying to think if there's any differences. Well, there's real wars. But as far as how we dealt with the Cold War, we're dealing with the Middle East and terrorism the same way, but we're also dealing with so-called domestic terrorism the same way.
Look, it's when the only tool you have are counterterrorism tools, every problem becomes a counterterrorism problem. So,
as long as you can make the argument.
So if parents are pissed off at the local school board and they show up to say, you people are a bunch of weirdos and you're miseducating our children, that smells like domestic terrorism to me. See,
you go traditional Latin mass?
I got a hammer.
And
I can use it to pound nails in. So everything I see is a nail. But it's not
that's
just
a screw.
You talked about we've been so used to terrorism and the Cold War.
Have never known. I mean, our youngest generation has never known anything other.
Yeah, well, a couple of excursions to Iraq and Vietnam aside, we've never actually had to deal with war.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Since
1946.
What happens if we do? Because I came across this at 38 North. Now, for those of you who don't know, 38 North is kind of a clearinghouse of national security experts who concentrate their expertise on Korea. And they're both governmental people, academics, and whatever. And they provide analyses of what's going on in Korea. And last week, or January 11th, so 10 days ago, a week and a half ago, Bob Carlin and Siegfried Hecker said this: is Kim Jong-un preparing for war? And they have a couple of points. That at the Hanoi summit with Trump, that failed. That failure cost Kim Jong-un a massive loss of face. He felt he had risked North Korea's security and lost because Donald Trump would not give him everything he wanted. So, in the summer and autumn of 21, they began to feel that the United States was in global retreat. I can't imagine why they would feel that way in that particular time period, the summer and autumn of 2021, post-Afghanistan. And therefore, in 2023, they began calling for preparations for a revolutionary war, for accomplishing reunification with South Korea. Last month, Kim said that, and this is a quote from him, North-South relations have been completely fixed into the relations between two states hostile to each other and the relations between two belligerent states, not the consanguineous or homogeneous ones anymore. In other words, South Korea is a legitimate target for North Korea's military power, however you define military power. The trouble, well,
that's the old elbow room argument from Lebensraum from the Germans.
And the trouble is that, as I've said many times before on this podcast, we could always depend on the Soviet Union, certainly post-Stalin, to act relatively rationally and legalistically. We might not have liked what they have done, but they always had some plausible excuse to explain why the horrific things they were doing were compatible with international law. The Soviets didn't invade Afghanistan. There was an Afghanistan revolution, and the new government was a recognized government by the Soviet Union.
Hey, they asked me in.
And they asked for our help. So we always knew what the bounds of Soviet responses would be, because they had collective leadership. That was one of the things that did change after Stalin. Having one guy make decisions turned out not to be a great idea, and so they went back to more collegial leadership. That does not exist.
It was good for the picture touching up business, though.
Yeah, but I mean, that does not exist in North Korea. Kim Jong-un runs the place just as his father did and just as his grandfather did, like his personal dog.
Yeah.
And so you can't reliably predict what a single totalist dictator is going to do. And you can't assume that they have made rational calculations about what the results of their actions will be. Because in a state where if anyone tells you no, you can just stick them in front of an artillery piece and blow them apart, people tend not to tell you no. You tend not to get information that it is suspected you don't want to hear. And so you don't make decisions on the basis of logical, reliable, rational information. So the fear is that the way North Korea would do this, look, they assume that, I think they know that conventionally, if they were to invade South Korea, they'd get their asses kicked. I think they have to know that their 1950s army is not going to beat a 2024 modern military force like the one South Korea can put into the field. However, they do have 50 or 60 nuclear warheads. So what happens if, knowing that Japan and the United States are going to be uncomfortable with another Korean, with a North Korean victory in another Korean war, what if you just nuke Seoul and Tokyo and Yokohama and the U.S. base, our forward base in Guam, and say, if you interfere in this, we'll keep nuking you. And then take over South Korea.
That's it. Yeah, that's a great question. Except, and this was I thought this was a good article. It was informative and it was thought provoking. And I'm glad people are thinking outside the box, because we do need to. But there is short shrift, I think, given to deterrence. And the other name that was missing from there is China. For all intents and purposes, North Korea is a client state of China, as much as Cuba is a client state of the Soviet Union. And they don't grow anything. They don't sell anything. There's nothing on which to base their economy. They are beholden to the Chinese for most of what they can get out of actually feeding their people, clothing them, housing them. They're completely dependent on China. So to not discuss how their fealty to China weighs into this, because I happen to think, and we talked about this a while ago, I can't remember if it was on the podcast or not, but we have definitely talked before about how China wants Taiwan, but they need certain conditions before they can make that move. And some of those conditions are having America occupied elsewhere. Helping out Russia helps America be occupied elsewhere. Helping out Hamas.
Helping out Ukraine. Well, you mean them helping out. Okay.
Yeah, China helping out Russia forces us into it. China helping out Hamas through Iran, that helps contain us. In order to go after North Korea or after Taiwan, having North Korea launch some ludicrous, tilting at windmills type of action is the only reason that they would get behind that, and they would have to be behind it. Well, one of two choices. Either China is behind it and backs it, or they don't know anything about it and North Korea has gone completely loony. That's a possibility that you're talking about, and you're absolutely right that most people haven't taken into account. But how likely is it that he went completely loony? I don't think he's loony. I think he's very calculated. So what does he get out of this?
Well,
a distraction from taking over Taiwan? Well, I think this is all tied up together.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second. Let's talk about this real quick first. This week, 38 North published a rebuttal from Thomas Schaefer, who agrees that the danger of a military confrontation on the Korean Peninsula has been growing for some time, and it keeps growing. However, and he agrees that international conditions are favorable for North Korea and Pyongyang in terms of increasing tensions. But what he is thinking of, that what he believes is happening, is an escalation of rhetoric prior to the U.S. election, with the calculation being that they think if Trump wins, they can get a better deal by doing some saber rattling during election season.
Yeah, well, that's the common Democrat Party talking point, is that these tyrants love Republicans because they'll work with tyrants. Hey, look at Richard Nixon. He was the one that went to China, not us. it is true that the first summit between Trump and Yoon was successful from both the Trump administration and Yoon, so North Korea, because it's only his opinion.
Oh, you mean Kim?
I mean Kim, rather. And the second one was, I thought that the previous article actually identified that it was risky, because you remember right after that failure in Hanoi happened, that was when we started getting all these rumors about how Kim's sister was going to be taking over and how she was more prominent. Matter of fact, there was all that stuff around the Olympics. Remember, going to the Olympic events or, whatever, which were in China. There is something to that. However, at the end of the day, assuming that even half of those warheads that the Norks may have work and can be delivered, are they really going to make that sort of risk? Why would they blow up Seoul if they intend to take over the country?
Well, one of the things that
just killed them, the major part of the country.
One of the things that Schaefer points out is that, look, Kim does this all the time. I mean, this has been his modus operandi for years, which is to start saber rattling and then get, and look, he did it all through the 1990s. get Madeleine Albright back over to Pyongyang to work out some deal. And he's been doing this over and over. He didn't get what he wanted in 2019. So does that mean he's willing to go to war? But let's discuss a nightmare scenario. He does go to war. And the sole reason that he goes to war is because China wants him to go to war. And they don't really give a shit whether he takes over South Korea or not. But what they do give a shit is that he concentrates all of the military might of Japan, to the extent that it has any, and the United States in Korea, so that they can just do a hop, skip, and jump over the pond to take over Taiwan at the same time. Because that leaves us with a serious strategic problem. Do we stop the Koreans, the North Koreans, or do we stop the Chinese?
It challenges the entire East Asia seaboard, including Southeast Asia, Philippines, Vietnam, Cambodia, even as far down as Australia. And what's Australia going to do? They don't have any of those submarines yet. So, I mean, it poses a huge question to the bishop, you would say, in chess. You know, are you feeling froggy? Are you going to leap? Or, you know, what are you actually going to do? How can you stop us?
Yeah, and if China just says, and by the way, if you try to stop us from taking over Taiwan, we'll nuke Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, deterrence works both ways.
That's right.
You know, it's one thing to go to war with China in 1950, whenever it was just human wave attacks. It was tough, but we could deal with that. It's the reason why we haven't had a direct land war confrontation with Russia since 1948. They have nukes. And that opens up an entirely new thing. And by the way, your mention of Australia reminds me of a clip I saw from an Australian comedy show, kind of in the same vein of Parks and Recreation, where you follow these Australian government officials around. And they had this one thing where they were meeting with Australian defense officials, army officers, largely Navy officers, and they were talking about how much they needed an increase in the defense budget to defend against, you know, threats in the Asian theater. And the main star of the show is like, well, what threats? Well, you know, just general threats. And they wouldn't answer. And he finally said, look, I'll just say something. And if I'm right, you nod. China? Yeah, they all nod. And he says, so what are our goals? And protect our trade routes is what it finally came down to. Right? And who's our largest trading partner? China. So our policy is to increase defense spending to prevent a threat to our trade with China from China. Yes.
Well, when you say it that way.
Yeah, when you say it that way, it seems kind of weird. But yeah, this whole thing about, and it could happen this year. So,
well, and look, that's why the prediction about helping Trump, you know what? It could be true. I mean, I can't toss that out as not a possibility.
Yeah. And then we have to take another step, by the way, from chat. I'm sorry, I haven't been paying attention to chat. But my first question is whether or not North Korea could actually save up enough fuel and food for a campaign. Again.
Yeah, that's absolutely good question.
It's a great question, but I think you have to figure out what China's aim in all of this is, because I think that's more
important. Again, that's my point. This isn't a North Korea question. This is a China question.
Yeah. And then we have to take another step back and look at something we've discussed before here and there, China's demography. China is facing a demographic collapse. By 2100, China's they are in a demographic collapse. By 2030, retirees will outnumber workers in China. The Chinese population is going to decline from 1.2 billion to around 500 million by 2100. China's time window to do anything is narrowing daily. Now, one of the things that, China's military says is they want to become, and look, China knows their military sucks. And so what they have said is they want to become a world-class military by 2035. One of the things that the Chinese have been doing are these anti-corruption campaigns. Just this last month, they disappeared about 9 senior generals in the Chinese rocket forces for corruption. And there was that article about, you know, missiles being filled with water and missile hatches over missile silos that wouldn't actually open and all this other stuff due to corruption.
And this is China, not North Korea.
Yeah, and this is China. And so considering their demographic collapse, one has to ask if China has until 2035 to build such a force. And also one has to ask if China can wait until 2035 when the majority of their population will now be retirees who have to be taken care of somehow, whether China can afford at that point an attack on Taiwan. Is this something that if Xi wants to accomplish it, has to be done sooner rather than later?
You know, it's interesting too, because China has been having a problem with its mostly male younger population in that they can't find jobs or don't want to find jobs. And so they live with their parents and they expect their parents to take care of them. And this is all off the government dime. Is that where the conscripts come from? And how motivated of a military would it be? So they're kind of getting it from both ends. Not only are they not getting new blood into the system as the old system dies off, as the old people die off, they're not getting replaced by real replacements. They're getting replaced by needy people who are going to be needy all their lives. So it's a demographic nightmare times 10 in a lot of ways. What are they going to do with all those people? Declaring a war is at least one way to make them useful.
And
although
also,
you're still going to have to pay for them.
Yeah, the trouble is that it's also a way of getting rid of your younger generation and ensuring that demographic collapse happens even faster.
It's even faster, that's right. If you think it out that far. And to be fair to Chinese and actually really most Asian cultures, they do have long vision for what they want to accomplish for their culture, their society, and they are perfectly willing to sacrifice lots of people in order to do that. Individual lives don't really matter much in most Eastern cultures, so the collective rules all. And as long as it's good for the collective, they'll make the sacrifice. It's just, can they actually recover and do anything from that? And I'm not sure that they can.
Well,
modern world is going to still go on.
But I'm beginning to feel the fear that if they're going to do anything, they have to do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, the timing wise, yes, it does. The sense of urgency is up. I that's the part of the original article that I agreed with. And I appreciated looking outside the box. I hate that fucking term. Now that's actually the box, is looking outside the box.
Yeah, well,
let's go back inside the box. See what was in there.
Look,
dude, maybe we missed something.
My problem with the original article was that it did have a lot of flavor about of 1970s and 1980s Sovietology, right?
Yes.
Who's standing closer to Brezhnev on the top of Lenin's tomb during the May Day parade?
Right.
Is it?
Well, you brought that up earlier.
Yeah. Yes. Is it? Well, offline. Yes, I did. It was just you and I talking.
Oh, that was offline.
Yeah,
okay,
that was prior to the podcast. And the problem is we don't. The reason they call it the Hermit Kingdom is because we don't actually know what's going on in there.
Right.
We're really limited. Even the best Western analyst is limited to whatever public statements are being made at party conferences
How
or
do you
what have
infiltrate
you.
that system?
Yeah, you can't.
How do you reliably infiltrate that system?
Yeah, well, you go to North Korea, you are Korean, you have a child, and then you spend an entire lifetime training that child to be a spy, and then you put him in the communist system. And then when he grows up and he's 30 years old, then he can begin reliably transmitting information. Absent that, human intelligence is probably pretty thin on the ground. Now, there are always defectors, and you can always interview defectors who make it to South Korea or wherever. I'm sure that's a great source of information. But on a day-to-day basis, it's whatever the South, whatever the North Koreans say publicly. And
look, we have plenty of satellites on North Korea. We already know how shitty it sucks there. We know very well that it's mostly Potemkin villages and then one great big, super center in the middle of Pyongyang. We know everybody else is either starving, freezing to death.
Well,
they're just in shit circumstances.
Yeah, they're just hungry enough to be malnourished and discouraged, but not so hungry that they might decide that shooting the local party cadre would improve their situation. It's a very
well, and that shooting and that local party cadre has got a lot of people who are well fed, well taken care of. I mean, it really is. It's a mafioso state.
Yeah, but as far as China goes, it's entirely possible, thank you, chat, that China could return to the cyclical warring states period. Well, that tends to be the arc of Chinese history.
That's true, yeah.
Good we're point. Very powerful, we're very united, now we're right. ruled by a bunch of warlords, regional warlords. And then sooner or later, one of those regional warlords manages to take control, and we're united and powerful again. Until the next cycle of warlords.
Except now that the ruling party, since communism, that ruling party has all the means of, insider-outsider differentiation. And only the insiders are going to get enough of the information, of the weapons, of the food, or whatever else, the medicines. And all the outsiders simply suffer at the insiders' discretion. So it's nigh on impossible to form. You can't form a popular front against that. Hong Kong was the closest thing, and we saw how long it took China to
look
kind of rush out of that.
You can form a popular front against that sort of thing, but only in certain circumstances. Again, think of Nicolae Ceausescu. Sure, he ran the country with an iron fist from the end of World War II until 1989. And it took basically the Soviet Union falling apart and releasing Warsaw Pact and the wall coming down in Berlin for people who had been under this guy's thumb since 1945 to say, hey, you know what? Maybe we can shoot this fucker. And in 40...
Hey, it turns out he's not impervious to bullets. Yeah.
In 48 hours,
we're hanging.
Yeah, in 48 hours, he went from dictator to assuming room temperature. So it's possible, but there's a lot of external things that have to happen to make that possible. I just don't think that
and
China's
the
there
difference
yet.
Between an Eastern European state and China is that those Eastern European states abutted Western countries. I think that makes a huge difference, whereas China is completely isolated. I mean, the closest thing they have to a Western country is Japan.
Russia.
And they've hated Japan forever.
Yeah, no. Russia has been the idiot stepsister to Western civilization, as P.J. O'Rourke once put it, for right. hundreds of years. And China's largest border is shared with Russia. But mm-hmm. Russia has been a communist country and is now a dictatorship. So there's no, there's not a lot. And besides, it's also Western Russia, which is basically Siberia, where no one lives. So, it's not like Romania, where you can just sort of look over the border and see what's right. happening. It's entirely different. The other bordering countries.
I can see Russia from my house.
Yeah, the other bordering countries are North Korea, non-starter there.
Right.
Mongolia, non-starter there.
Right.
So there's
Cambodia,
Vietnam.
Vietnam,
Yeah. So, you know, they don't have.
India. India is the one that gives them the most problems.
Yes. But
And
China.
that's it's like a, that's a tiny, they control Nepal. They basically control all the Himalayan mountains. I mean, what they don't, there's no, if you wanted to escape China and you know nothing but what China has taught you, where the fuck would you go?
Yeah,
Right?
they're
What would you even, where would you even think to go to?
yeah, there are not a lot of choices. So it's isolated in a way that Romania was not. And we don't have the basically the collapse of the Warsaw Pact to help out. So I don't think that China is in any position to have some sort of internal popular front to run it. And look, the only reason that the communists were able to win, I think, was because A, the Republic of China was so fractured. You talk about the Warring States period. In many ways, the Republic of China from 1920 to 1949 had technically a central government, but it was largely warlords who were running the show out in the
And it was
provinces.
largely run by Western powers anyway, or at least influenced by Western powers.
Yeah, so this is the Chinese Empire, and there are no Mongols. There's nothing to break it up right now. So
Right.
China's problems are all in China does not have, well, it does have international worries, but China's international worries are largely trade-based, right? They can't produce enough energy to keep all the lights on. They can't produce enough food to keep people fed. So they're a net food importer. They're a net energy importer. So China's primary day-to-day strategic concern is keeping the Persian Gulf open and keeping food shipments coming in. And
Well, because one of their major clients, which they share with Russia, is Iran. They've also shared lots of stuff with Pakistan. They've taken, they've invested a hell of a lot in Africa, especially on the southern east coast, Zimbabwe, Zambia, all that Belt and Roads Initiative stuff that. That went to winning hearts and minds and paying lots and lots and lots of money to build things for these people. In South Africa, they tried to do the same thing.
Yes, and that is all a trade-based initiative. What China
Yes, but
doesn't.
well, essentially, it's also, I mean, it's a mercantilist attitude, but with the communism mixed in, it's also an ideologically expressed, and they're trying to spread the ideology through the economics. Because I mean, that is Marx's vision, right?
Right, but the important thing to remember is that China's international concerns do not include an invasion or land war. China is not worried about
Nor
its.
do they get sucked into defending any other countries.
Yeah, China is not worried about invasion, which makes you wonder exactly what the military they're building is designed to do. Because China doesn't face an invasion threat from anyone, with the possible exception of India. And quite frankly, India doesn't want to invade China.
India is one of those Asian countries with long, long, long-term vision.
And by the way, invading China from India,
That would be kind of difficult.
that would be quite a trick.
That'd be something worthy of the man who would be king.
So you have to wonder if China's military modernization is an expeditionary modernization, not a defensive modernization. And
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
with all of the other problems they face demographically and what have you, the time horizon for using that military, and they are spending a huge amount of money to build it up. They're trying to build a blue water navy. They haven't done a big job of it so far, but they're trying. And building a blue water navy costs a lot of money. You know, we talk about China's navy and how they have 1,000 ships. Yeah, and 800 of them are coastal patrol vessels. whose range is limited to 200 nautical miles of the Chinese coast. So,
Yeah, you can't just build an aircraft carrier and send it out into the world.
yeah, I
There's a
mean,
whole
you've got to,
fleet that goes with that.
yeah, you got to have destroyers and you've got to have cruisers and the whole set of all those.
Supply ships, submarines. I mean,
Yeah, blue water
there's actually a
navies.
lot of shit that goes into that.
Yeah, you can build as many aircraft carriers as you want. You just can't send them anywhere unless you have the rest of the navy that goes along with them. So, but China is trying to build that navy, and you have to ask yourself why. What is China, a country that faces no threat of invasion, literally? What is the purpose of China's power projection? What's the purpose of building a navy? I think they know, as Jesus once said, whatsoever thou doest, do quickly. I think they know that that is the situation they're in. Because
I agree with you. The Overton window, the timeline, whatever you want to call it, that they have to make a decision that they've been waiting to make for a very long time. Well, I guess basically since 1940. What did Mao come in? 42? 49? I can't remember.
Mao came in
But
49.
49. They've been waiting to make this decision for a very long time. And again, I hark back to the Asian cultures and their amazing cultural patience to serve revenge or retribution or whatever you want to call it, whatever it is. They've had their sights on joining, even though that's not what happened, but at least bringing Taiwan back into the fold. Killing anybody that Chiang Kai-shek had any relation to whatsoever. And then dominating the South China Sea.
Yeah,
And
but
that's more directly against the Philippines and Singapore and Japan.
realistically, after 2035, probably after 2030, those are
With
not,
population and demographic decline, yeah,
those are
they're
not
going to run
achievable
out of
dreams.
resources.
Yeah, they are running out of time. And they're running out of time and they're running out of young men that they can sacrifice.
Well, that's the other thing too, is in order, so I know there's a rule of thumb in the US military for how long it takes a day one blunt recruit to turn him into a soldier. And part of that includes getting blooded. I mean, he needs to actually see real action at some point in order to actually then reach the stage where he can not only train, but lead new soldiers coming into the fort to get new sergeants and possibly officers out of that. I mean, it takes time. That's not a, you can't do that overnight. I can't give you a book and say, read this, and you're going to be an expert in everything warlike,
No, I mean, look, during World War II, we would probably put guys through 6 weeks of basic training, 6 weeks of infantry school, and then we'd drop them in the middle of the Hürtgen forest. And, good luck to you. And most of those replacements just got bumped off immediately. You can do it. To make a soldier, somebody who can, an 18-year-old who can stand on a piece of ground with a rifle, you can do it in as little as 12 weeks.
But what do you do after?
But they're not going to be super effective. The problem is how do you make staff sergeants and master sergeants, and how do you make majors and lieutenant colonels? That is the 15 to 20-year gap you have to cross. So you need effective leadership, and of course
Field leadership,
I'm sure that a
people who are
Chinese,
on the ground with the troops doing the heavy work.
yeah, but
You need that kind of stuff.
I'm sure that the Chinese don't give their sergeants a lot of responsibility. So their concentration is building officers, building an officer corps. And again, you're still probably 10 to 15 years of service before you can build people who can effectively command large units in combat. Obviously, you can make a company commander in 3 or 4 years, which we do all the time. Captains are routinely company commanders, and you know, 1 year as a second lieutenant, 2 years as a first lieutenant. You can technically, I think, still make captain in 3 years. And then you can be given command of a company. But that, you know, that's 100 guys. It's useful, but that's a 3 year experience gap to getting there.
Or 100 guys.
Yeah. No, 130-ish, 150-ish, somewhere in there. It depends on what that's going
to be. And so in order to run an actual military, not only are you going to have the expertise in place to train, replace, adapt, overcome, and lead, all at the same time, from a group of people who only learned it for at best 24 months, 2 years. How do you hold it after that? Say you make remarkable gains. Your training program is so freaking perfect that you're able to overrun an enemy and take possession of whatever it is you took possession of. And now how do you hold it? Because there's that's never the end of the story.
Yeah, well, holding a position is a heck of a lot easier than taking a position in the first place, because at least you have something to defend, and you can largely do that from fixed positions. But I think at this point that would take us into a longer, more complicated conversation that we just don't have
like
time
ending
for.
On that. Now we give everybody something to think about.
Yeah, think about that for
we'll
the
come
next
back
week.
With lots of comments next week. Man, Michael, what an idiot! God damn it, Wade.
Michael, have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, we'll see y'all.
You have been watching the Observations Podcast. That's what it's called. The Observations Podcast for the 21st of January, 2024. As always, we thank you for joining us on the podcast, and we hope you'll be joining us again next time. Until then, have a great week, everybody. So long.